You're listening to On Shifting Ground. I'm Ray Suarez. As President Joe Biden and former President Donald Trump signal the beginning of their campaigns for the 2024 election, America stands on the verge of another contentious contest. In 2020, the candidates had wildly different visions for solving the issue of immigration, but it remains in limbo. And the end of pandemic-era policy has brought new uncertainty. So the immigration debate will likely be as big and as pressing in the next election cycle. Voters will be asking, what has President Biden actually accomplished on U.S. immigration policy? What does the end of pandemic-era border restriction mean for our southern border? And more importantly, why has large-scale immigration reform been stuck in Congress for so long? Joining me to answer these questions is Sabrina Rodriguez, national politics reporter for The Washington Post. In her reporting, she chronicles the shifting demographics of swing states. Welcome to On Shifting Ground.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Well, President Joe Biden and former President Donald Trump are preparing a road to the Oval Office, but one key issue remains particularly in limbo: immigration. From 2017, when he took office, to 2021, when he left, Donald Trump definitely centered immigration, with people like Stephen Miller and Steve Bannon having his ear. He was very active, both rhetorically and in nuts and bolts policy terms. Joe Biden's been president for 2 years. Has he rolled back or changed the restrictions put in place during the Trump era?
It's been a combination in reality. You know, on the campaign trail, Joe Biden talked very much about how he was going to restore a fair and humane immigration system and how he was going to roll back all these policies that the Trump administration had put in place. But his administration officials very quickly realized that's a lot easier said than done. There was a lot that Trump did in his administration that then made it harder to roll back. You know, we're seeing the Biden administration talking about now the end of Title 42, a public health order that Trump put in place at the start of the pandemic. And again, we're talking about something that was put in place in early 2020. We're now in 2023, and we're still talking about this policy and what the effects are going to be on the immigration system. So it's been something that a lot of the changes that Trump did were not something that you could overnight switch off.
One significant move during the Trump years was to reduce the number of refugees accepted by the United States at a time when global crises like the civil war in Syria saw huge numbers of people fleeing armed conflict, fleeing for their lives. Has the U.S. restored the number of refugees it's accepting to its pre-Trump numbers?
So the Biden administration changed the cap. So they, you know, once Trump was out of office, they said, okay, we'll lift the number of refugees that we'll accept. But because they have lifted that number to try and get closer to pre-Trump levels, does not mean that they have actually accepted that many refugees.
The difference between intention and production.
Yes. Them saying, okay, we'll accept this many thousand refugees does not mean that they have actually accepted that many thousand refugees. There was a period of time where they were criticized because they were going to keep a very low cap. They ultimately raised that cap, but they did not meet those numbers of refugees coming in. And there's a lot of red tape and explanations that you'll get administration officials telling you about why, but the fact is that they have not met those numbers and have not reached really pre-Trump era numbers, although they have said they have that intention and would want to be able to do that.
I was recently interviewing one of the leaders of HIAS, the Refugee Resettlement Agency, that began over a century ago helping Jewish refugees from Europe mostly, but now really helps people from everywhere trying to resettle in the United States. And he said to me that he understood why it was happening, but that Biden administration officials were being so cautious on the so-called extreme vetting that's now in place. They were so worried about something going wrong that even the announced intention to bring up the number of refugees wasn't turning into actual acceptances just because it's considered just so fraught, so risky politically. Is that a fair case to make?
Yes. I mean, the reality is that immigration is complicated. That has always been the case. But because of the immigration system and what refugee is versus asylum seeker versus undocumented immigrant versus all the different distinctions, it's easily conflated. And what we've seen is in politics, and specifically the Republican Party, has used how complicated immigration is to focus in on refugees are the same as asylum seekers, are the same as undocumented. It's all the same. We're going to talk about it like it's the same thing. So in politics, it's become much more complicated to say, oh, well, we're accepting, you know, refugees that are fleeing these countries and the situations that are happening in these different countries versus that's different than what we're seeing at the border. Or that's different than DACA recipients. And there's so many different distinctions. And that's where it gets used politically, where, well, any notion that the administration is willing to accept more people is viewed negatively by the Republican Party and is going to be used politically.
One particular area of policy that has gotten attention in both administrations was temporary protected status, which in Trump world was regarded like a free ticket to the United States that never gets reexamined, even when the country you come from may not be in imminent danger any longer. Joe Biden has extended TPS for some countries, not others. What's the state of play right now with temporary protected status?
I mean, we've seen the Biden administration use it sparingly, but use it to help certain countries and certain groups of immigrants in the U.S. For example, one of the first actions that we saw from the Biden administration was granting temporary protected status to Venezuelans, which is something that had been discussed a lot under the Trump administration. Ultimately, in his last days in office, Trump used another power because he didn't want to use temporary protected status. He used another one that's called deforced and forced departure, DED. And it's very similar to temporary protected status, but it was a good indicator of the fact that Trump did not like using TPS. But we saw the Biden administration use that for Venezuela very early on. It often is renewed for all the countries that are involved. They will renew it and extend it. The question and the tension is always, do you expand it to allow other people to also qualify? Do you change the date that the person had to be in the United States for them to also be able to qualify for that temporary protected status? And what we've seen is the Biden administration shy away from doing that and saying, okay, the people that qualified before will be able to qualify still, but we're not going to change those dates to expand who could qualify for protected status.
I'm glad you made a distinction between the sort of announcement of directions versus what really goes on. I think during the recent CNN town hall meeting in New Hampshire, we saw an example of that with President Trump insisting that he had, in fact, finished the wall, and correspondent Caitlin Collins pushing back that he hadn't finished the wall. And they sort of argued to a standstill because it depends on what you mean by finished and built as opposed to just repaired or the other terms that you could use. It ends up kind of leaving it in limbo. What is the real situation with the wall, apart from walking all 1,500 miles of border? Can you really know how much is out there?
No. And the reality is, I mean, and I will say this, having covered immigration, you know, I started covering immigration during the Trump administration and would hear all the conversation about the border. And I had not been to South Texas. I had not been along the border. And once I went in person, you see what it means. And we're talking about neighborhoods that there are houses that are on the other side of the border wall, because the border wall is not exactly where border is. I mean, it's such an abstract concept to think that there is like this perfect line of the border and there's going to be a wall. I think it's so hard to truly grasp what it looks like. And we're talking about neighborhoods that have a wall in front of them, areas where a wall ends and there's just miles of nothing. So this idea that there's going to be 1,500 miles of a wall, it's not possible. I'm sure there are people that argue that it is very possible and that that is what should happen. But when you're on the ground and you're seeing what it looks like, I mean, this is impacting people's neighborhoods. This is not like empty, vast land where border walls are being placed. These are communities of people that are living along the border and are seeing some of the impacts. For some people, it's, you know, if you live along the border, there's many people that will go back and forth from the US to Mexico, and this has complicated that for them. There's people that are dealing with the environmental impacts of the border wall because it's in some of it isn't like unprotected, like wildlife land and such. So there's a very real life consequence to this border wall, depending on where you are along the border.
As you mentioned earlier in the conversation, Title 42 has expired, a pandemic era measure meant to slow down traffic at the border using public health exceptions in order to do it. The word has gone out. The countries that have been sending large numbers of people to the southern border, it's well known that Title 42 is expiring, and there are said to be many, many thousands of people on their way. What's been done in anticipation of a surge at the border?
The administration has been trying to figure out what policy best to implement in these months. I mean, this is not something that is a surprise that it was coming. You know, the administration since day one knew that ultimately Title 42 would have to end. It was a public health order that was invoked in the name of the pandemic. And the argument was that you had to stop allowing migrants to come and seek asylum in the U.S. to help stop the spread of COVID. Once the president declared that the pandemic is over, and there was so much talk about how we're in a new phase with this pandemic, it was known that that was going to end. And there were plenty of court challenges around it. And there have been members of Congress that have tried to propose finding ways to keep something like Title 42 in place to still stop people from being able to seek asylum at the border. But the fact is that Title 42 was going to go away. So what we've seen in the months leading up to the end of Title 42 has been the administration negotiating with Mexico and the Mexican government to accept more migrants so that they can keep turning away people when they come to the border. They got Mexico to agree that they will accept people from several countries, including Cuba, Haiti, Nicaragua, nationals from other countries that they wouldn't have necessarily accepted in the past. They also are going to do something that actually came up in the Trump administration, which was to require that asylum seekers have looked for asylum in another country before getting to the United States. So migrants, for example, that arrive to the U.S. southern border and say they want to seek asylum, they can now be asked by officers for CBP and such. They can be asked, okay, well, did you try and seek asylum in Mexico? And if that is not the case, then they wouldn't be able to seek asylum in the United States. So all of these are measures essentially for them to try and stop people from trying to seek asylum in the United States. They've been very vocal in saying that they're going to be turning away people, very vocal in saying, you know, if you are going to come, try and schedule an appointment. They've done a CBP One app that has many glitches, and there's been widely reported the issues with the app, but telling people, like, do not just try and cross the border.
You mentioned Cubans and Haitians. There's a lot of different people showing up at the border. Who's coming lately?
It's a huge combination. We've seen that the administration has really tried to crack down specifically on Cubans, Venezuelans, and Nicaraguans because they were seeing a high influx from those countries. The political situation in those countries has a huge impact on why people are coming and in heightened numbers. But it's not just those countries. You know, I think in the past administration, there was an outsized focus on Mexico, Guatemala, Honduras, El Salvador. And those countries were really the countries that we saw the most people coming from. But it has really evolved in the past couple of years and in the wake of the pandemic and under the Biden administration, where it's from all of Latin America and not even just all of Latin America. I mean, I've seen stories of Russians that are coming to the U.S. southern border to try and seek asylum in the United States. So it really is an international crisis. It's not just about the border here. It's really about the situation in so many countries around the world where people are feeling the need to come and seek asylum in the U.S.
It is an astonishing thing to consider that there are people crossing Central America on foot. they make it to the eastern coast, the Caribbean / Atlantic coast of this hemisphere, and start heading north by bus, by train, hitchhiking, and walking. The Darien Gap in Panama is one of the most physically forbidding places to be a pedestrian that I can imagine. And thousands of people are heading on foot, risking their lives, risking their future health, and reminding us that all kinds of people are coming from all kinds of places. There are people booking cheap passages from West Africa to Eastern Brazil, which is, you know, take out a map and look at it. It's a relatively short hop, and heading north to the southern border of the United States. Now that wet foot, dry foot has been ended as a policy by the United States, which promised Cubans that if they got their 2 feet on American soil, they could stay. Now that that's over, they are booking cheap visa-free passages to Yucatan, to eastern Mexico, and heading north. When a Cuban makes it to Ciudad Juarez, are we generally still letting them in?
Yes, many Cubans are still able to come into the United States and seek asylum. And the administration, because of just the numbers that were coming in, tried to change the policy. So one of the things they did to try and deter Cubans from crossing the border, because there was the threat of either sending them back into Mexico or sending them back to Cuba, or having Mexico send them back to Cuba, they tried to create this policy, which they're pushing forward now, and they're expanding to include other countries as well. That would be family parole, would be family reunification. So if you could prove that you had someone in the U.S. that was going to claim you and was able to provide you housing, or was able to show that they're going to help pay for you living in the United States, that you could request that and then come into the United States. But we have seen that there is still a high number of Cubans that are coming to the border and are able to come into the United States.
You're listening to On Shifting Ground. I'm Ray Suarez. My guest is Sabrina Rodriguez, national politics reporter for The Washington Post. Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, which you also mentioned earlier, DACA, was for a long time described as the low-hanging fruit of raging immigration debates. People who were kids when they came into the country undocumented were considered more sympathetic figures than the parents who brought them. Heavily concentrated in states that are heavily counted on by Republicans and Democrats, California, New York, Florida, Texas, are they less important politically because those states are pretty much spoken for in a national election? Are they less likely to get attention, even though their status is still fragile and legally vulnerable?
I mean, it depends when we're talking about the political debate. I think the bigger issue is that the border has taken outsized attention. That is what gets the most attention when we talk about immigration. So everything else, talking about Dreamers, talking about the future of DACA, always ends up taking a back seat in these arguments. You know, when you go to Capitol Hill and you say, okay, well, do you support a pathway to citizenship for Dreamers? You will find members of Congress on both sides of the aisle that will say, yes, they do. But what oftentimes comes up then in the case of moderates and Republicans is them saying, yes, but the border. Yes, but the border is the focus. The border is what needs to take precedence. We can't be talking about offering legal status or offering pathways to citizenship when we need to be focusing on the border. That's usually the way that Republicans try and kind of move away from offering that pathway to citizenship, which is something that for years we have seen in polling is politically popular. The idea of offering a pathway to citizenship for undocumented, the children that were brought into the United States, Dreamers, as we call them, there's been so much conversation and survey and polling that shows that that is politically popular. But again, it gets conflated with what's happening at the border, and then people move away from it.
Isn't that also the case, talking about polling, with undocumented immigrants more broadly? The average person who's living here out of status has been in the United States for 10 and a half years. They are not like people who have just crossed the border yesterday. They own houses. They have long-term employment. They have citizen children in schools around the country. They are soaked into the pores of a lot of places in the United States, and there doesn't seem to be a tremendous amount of appetite for roundups and widespread deportations yet. When political season rolls around, one of our national parties talks about exactly that. What are Americans telling public opinion researchers about what they'd like to happen to the, whatever, 12.5 million people living here out of status?
Yeah, we have seen in polling consistently, and that's not something that necessarily changed significantly under the Trump administration. I mean, polling does show that a majority of Americans support some type of legal status. There's obviously, depending on the poll, depending on the way that the questions were framed and such, is what they think should be done, if it should be just offering residency versus offering pathway to citizenship. What does pathway to citizenship look like? I mean, we've seen over the years, over the decades, we've seen dozens of bills go through Capitol Hill with different versions of that. How many years it would take? What are the requirements? I mean, the process would look different depending on which version of the bill or which president we've had in office that has talked about this. But it is something that we've consistently seen that there is support with a majority of Americans wanting to see happen, some level of legal status for people. And that is something we've seen some level of Republican support for as well. The problem is the amount of anti-immigrant rhetoric that we've heard, especially in the last, what is it now, 6-7 years in the U.S. that has made it so politically toxic to really deal with immigration in any way.
Demographers are talking about future shortages in the workforce. Several states have even loosened the rules on child labor, which is kind of surprising in 2023 to see that happening, but there it is. Does the demographic argument have appeal for Americans? Are we still willing to be an immigrant welcoming nation, in part because Americans are not so big on having kids anymore?
It is an argument that does come up. I think in the top line politics, you know, when we're talking about the presidential candidates and such, they won't necessarily talk about that on the campaign trail. We won't see, you know, Donald Trump talking about that in a CNN town hall or Biden necessarily talking about it when he's on the campaign trail in the coming months. But when we talk to local officials, that is something you often hear. I mean, that's something that really, when you're talking in small towns across the country that have seen an exodus of people, especially more suburban rural areas and just across the country, I mean, there are places that are saying, you know, for us to stay alive, we are going to need to have people here working. And if we can't fill those jobs with Americans that used to live in these communities, well, what is the alternative? The alternative are immigrants that have come to the United States and want to work or are willing to fill these jobs. That is a reality that we're seeing in towns across America, whether that is farm workers in California or shipbuilders in Wisconsin. I mean, it is something that we see across the country, and stories that I've heard really local officials, whether it's mayors or city council members, them saying, you know, we understand the rhetoric around immigration. We might have our own personal beliefs on that. But when we're talking about a manufacturing plant that has a huge labor shortage, well, what are we going to do about that? And having real questions around how to grapple with maybe what they personally feel with immigration to the realities of what they need.
Well, it sounds like the stage is set for another year of national arguments about these topics, certainly with the expiry of Title 42 and the new surge toward the border. Sabrina Rodriguez is a national politics reporter for The Washington Post. Thanks for joining us on Shifting Ground.
Thanks so much for having me.
You've been listening to On Shifting Ground, produced in partnership with KQED, with funding from listeners like you. Today's episode was produced by Elise Manoukian, Sienna Barnes, Adam Ailey, and Andrew Stelzer. It was mixed and mastered by Matteo Schimpf. Additional production and engineering were provided by Rob Spate. KQED's Jim Bennett is our technical supervisor. Jared Sport is our executive producer. Philip Yun is CEO of World Affairs. Our music is from Blue Dot Sessions. I'm Ray Suarez. Thanks for listening.